Good morning and welcome to the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. This morning, I'm delighted to welcome in a friend, John Hudgens, who is a filmmaker, television producer, just a fan of science fiction, all of those things rolled up into one package. Hey, John, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. Now, I met you when you worked at one of the local TV stations as a producer of Fabulous Things, and I also found out in the course of that time that you make your own movies, too. You had a documentary a couple of years ago about horror film hosts that was amused me very much.
Right. That was American Scary. It was about all the classic, you know, television hosts that every TV channel seemed to have back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, which unfortunately, you know, corporate television today, that's sort of gone by the wayside. Nobody does local production anymore.
Yeah, nobody has the chiller theater or the creature feature or the whatever.
We sort of came into that by accident. You know, a friend of mine got the idea to do a documentary on it, and he didn't know how to make a movie, and he knew I did, so he roped me into helping it out with it. And we kind of got it right about the perfect time because nobody had really documented this before, and a lot of them were at the age where these hosts were starting to die off, and we got a lot of them right before they did die off. So we were able to, you know, preserve some of their stories.
Yeah, a little bit of American history, the kind of kitschy American history. Now, the latest documentary that you've done is called Backyard Blockbusters, and you just had a successful screening of that at a science fiction convention in Atlanta, and maybe a lot of folks are not familiar with what a science fiction convention is, what Dragon Con is. So tell me a little bit about Dragon Con, a little bit about the screening of Backyard Blockbusters.
Well, Dragon Con is many things. It's one of the largest science fiction conventions in the South and in the United States, but it's a catch-all. I mean, it's not just comics. It's not just television.
Because Comic-Con is the one that gets all the publicity from San Diego.
And Comic-Con is a very corporate convention. I mean, it's essentially a trade show that fans attend.
Okay.
Dragon Con started off as a convention put on by fans, and it pretty much today still is a convention put on by fans for fans. It just pulls 75,000 people to downtown Atlanta.
Does the dragon refer to something that I should know, or is it just a cool name?
No, I think part of it referred to the founders of Dragon Con. They ran an online game. I think Dragon was like the name of their group.
And so it's lived on past the name, really.
Exactly.
Okay.
But, like I said, Dragon Con also has a film festival, and this year, you know, and I've premiered several of my films at Dragon Con, but this year they decided to lead off the film festival down there with Backyard Blockbusters because it's the perfect programming for something at Dragon Con because it's all about fans and fan activities.
Okay, so when I saw your pictures on Facebook of Dragon Con, you had these folks who were dressed up as their favorite science fiction character, and that's kind of what you do. That's the bit.
That's what some people do.
Now, if you take that to the next level and dress up as your favorite science fiction character, but then act out a movie, that's what a backyard blockbuster is. That's a fan film.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be that. I mean, so there have been some fan films that, you know, they're animation, they're full-scale productions. One of my favorites is just, I mean, it was just thrown together. It was called the $10 fan film. You know, the joke was that this one group bet another group that they couldn't make a fan film for $10, and so they made a fan film for $10. It looks like crap. But it's funny. That's the point. It's the content that matters. I mean, the thing is funny as heck.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I've seen some fan films where they threw thousands of dollars at them, and they're not worth watching.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, you have a history also. I mean, the reason what makes you an expert in fan films is that you are a fan filmmaker.
Yes. Back in the 80s, I used to do a lot of stuff. The big thing at science fiction conventions was doing a music videos, doing the video dance parties where people could either dance to the music or watch the videos. And, of course, at a science fiction convention, they want music videos that have a science fiction theme.
Just the Star Wars Cantina theme over and over again,
right.
Correct?
But you know, they don't exist. I know, but they don't exist, so we had to go out and make them. So I would take stuff like the Pointer Sisters, the Neutron Dance, and sync it up to Indiana Jones. You know, believe me, it works.
Really?
But we did like a 2-hour presentation full of these things. And that's what sort of led into me doing other things and getting the job working on Babylon 5, because Joe Straczynski hired me to do the exact same thing, but for his television show.
We're talking with John Hudgens, who has a movie called Backyard Blockbusters, which is also showing at the Secret City Film Festival. We'll tell you about that in a couple of minutes. So when you say you got a job on Babylon 5, I mean, that's a real network television program.
It was syndicated at the time, but yes.
Okay, but it was on regular over-the-air television. Mm-hmm. What do you mean you got a job on Babylon 5?
Well, at the time, it's one of those, you know, one of those things that it sounds ludicrous, but it actually happened. At the time, Babylon 5 was airing on the TV station. Well, the pilot was going to air on the TV station that I worked on at the time.
Okay.
And the creator of the show, Joe Straczynski, was online on Genie, which is, you know, like, you know, pre-internet type stuff.
Okay.
You know, things like CompuServe and Genie. And he was talking up the show and, right, you know, sort of doing advance publicity for the fans.
Same as somebody would nowadays on Facebook or Twitter.
Exactly. But, you know, we're talking 20 years ago. and Joe was having problems with the publicity department at Warner Brothers, where they would not give him publicity materials for his own program.
Really?
And we got two copies of the press kit in at our station, and I just mentioned on one of the groups that, hey, Joe, I've got an extra copy. Do you want it? And yes. Huh. And we struck up a friendship, and he had seen some of the videos that I'd done over
All
the
right.
years.
So he's in Los Angeles?
Exactly.
And you are in?
Here in Knoxville.
Okay.
And I did the first one just for the heck of it, you know, because it was along the lines of all the others that I'd done. And I sent it to him, and he's like, this is great. Can I use it at conventions? And I'm like, sure.
So a music video with Babylon 5 footage.
Right.
Awesome.
And then he writes me back and says, I've got an idea for another one. Here's what we can do. And I'm like, cool. I'm going to pay you for it. And I'm like, no, Joe, I'll do it as a favor. And he's like, no, you're going to take my money and be happy about it.
Well, because that fulfills the contract.
Exactly.
And fulfills his obligation.
Right. And we ended up doing like one a season for the rest of the run of the show, you know, usually
nice.
During the summer, and we debut it at Comic-Con or Dragon-Con or something like that.
All right. So you'd made the rounds of some of these other cons.
Oh, yeah.
These conventions throughout the years. Mm-hmm. All right. So now you've got this idea where, hey, I can get dressed up and my friends can get dressed up and we can do not just...
Not quite.
We're not up to that part yet?
No, we are and we aren't. What happened was, you know, we'd already seen the original, like the big things that had broken through, like Troops or George Lucas and Love, you know, the early film, the early viral videos.
Okay, so what this means is that someone has done sort of a spoof.
Exactly.
It's a parody. It's not like a reenactment, not a continuation of the story. But
Troops is a special case. It was basically done by a guy named Kevin Rubio out in Los Angeles, and it's basically positing what would the Cops television show look like in the Star Wars universe. And it just took off like crazy because at the time nobody was doing video on the internet. This was like the very first viral video.
Yeah, well, we didn't have computers fast enough to watch video.
Barely,
on the internet.
And it took like 8 to 10 hours to download the thing. but it was entertaining. But we'd seen things like that, and a friend of mine was visiting. He was back in town for a weekend, and we got this grand idea of taking all these toys over to Lowell Cunningham's house and enacting this big, making this big stop-motion battle.
All right, now, I've had the pleasure of meeting Lowell Cunningham through you, but you'll have mm-hmm. to explain to everybody else that
Lowell Cunningham is the creator of Men in Black. He lives here in Knoxville, and we've known him for years.
Did he go to UT?
Uh-huh.
With you?
No.
So.
Well, not with me at the same time.
Okay.
We knew each other through various other friends and fan clubs.
All right.
Like that.
Awesome. The creator of Men in Black, the comic book, is a Knoxvillian. And you got to take a second to wrap your head around mm-hmm. that for a moment. Because
he keeps a low profile.
No,
he's actually from Middle Tennessee, but he's lived here forever. You know,
okay.
He might as well be a Knoxvillian.
All right. But that's just kind of, you got to keep wrap your head around the fact that, okay, the guy who's created the whole idea of the Men in Black lives here. that you're friends with him.
Oh, yeah.
And that you decided to go ahead and make
well,
some stuff.
Well, the funny thing is back, you know, when Lowell first had the idea for the comic book, everybody was like, oh, yeah, right, sure, it's going to be a comic book. Okay, oh, it is. Are they going to make a movie of it? Right, I'll see it when, ooh, you know. But we went over to Lowell's house with this huge box of toys and got the we're going to make this stop motion epic. And we did one setup and found out this is a lot more work than we thought it was.
Yeah.
And so we started goofing around.
Because every frame of
exactly.
video is either 24 or 30 motions of the toy.
And we didn't want to spend that much time.
I mean, not every frame, every second of video is what I'm trying
right.
to say. Yeah.
So we started improvising some stuff, and Sandy grabbed the Watto character, who is the junk dealer in Star Wars Episode 1, and we started improvising this stuff, using all the junk we had there, as if Watto was, you know, doing like one of those old used car commercials, you know, Crazy Eddie or something like that. And, and of course, that turned into Crazy Watto. So we shot it. We didn't have a script. We just improv the whole thing.
Yeah.
I eventually took it all, edited it together, made it into some kind of sense, you know, and then put it up on the internet. And it became kind of popular.
Yeah.
So popular that it ran at the Cannes Film Festival in 2005.
Whoa. Crazy Watto.
Yes.
That's awesome. Now, word eventually has to get back to George Lucas or somebody who's created those characters, and they mm-hmm. can either squash you or say, yeah, go ahead.
Lucasfilm's been really cool about that. What they did. Most studios have been sort of like, you know, we're going to turn a blind eye.
Yeah.
Some studios like MGM have actually gone out and tried to go out and actively squash them.
Mm-hmm.
Paramount sort of looks the other direction, as long as you're not trying to make money off them.
Yeah, because Paramount, obviously, with Star Trek, mm-hmm. a lot of people are inspired by
right.
those, and there's a lot of Star Trek fan films.
There weren't as many to begin with, because Star Trek needs a lot more. You know, with Star Wars, you can get away with just two guys in the forest swinging lightsabers. With Star Trek, you know, you kind of need props. You need costumes. You need the sets. You know, you need the Enterprise.
Okay.
Because, you know, the Enterprise is a character all of its own, too.
True. We're talking with John Hudgens, the director of Backyard Blockbusters. You can find out more on the web at backyardblockbusters.net. Mm-hmm. It's a production of his company, Z-Team Productions, and it recently premiered over Labor Day weekend at the Dragon Con in Atlanta, and it's going to be at the Secret City Film Festival here, which is not in Oak Ridge. It's a pretty good secret.
Right.
They're having it in downtown West.
It used to be in Oak Ridge, but they moved to Knoxville this year because they worked out something with Regal Cinemas to do it at Downtown West, which is a much nicer theater.
And that is September
21st, 22nd, 23rd.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So we'll have some more information about that later in the program, but I just said that to reset the story.
Right.
Now, so you're chugging along. You've got sort of an okay. You've made Crazy Watto, mm-hmm. and Lucasfilm has been okay with it.
Well, what I was leading up to is Lucasfilm, what they did is starting in 2002, they started saying, not only are we going to acknowledge fan films, we're going to encourage them. They actually set up a contest where they actually encouraged fans to send in entries. You know,
that's the best way to do originally, it. It's so much better than trying to stifle.
Mm-hmm, originally, and it was parodies and documentaries only. You couldn't do fiction in the Star Wars universe because they were still making the films at the time.
Right.
But the way they set up the contest is George Lucas picked the grand prize every year. He actually personally picked one himself.
Nice.
And then the fans voted on their favorite every year. You know, the audience choice. And then there are various other categories, you know.
What kind of prize, like, or is it just enough of it to have recognition?
Well, the first couple of years, there were cash prizes. I think the George Lucas selects, it was $2,500. And then the audience choice. And you also got to have your film remixed at Skywalker Ranch.
Nice.
And then the audience choice. Unfortunately, audience choice, they never were able to have a cash prize because under California, you know, rules, that's not.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's luck of the draw and not, you know, voted on by, you know, a peer group.
Sure.
So unfortunately we never, two of the films I did won the audience choice award in 2003 and 2005. So, but we never got a cash prize, but we got really nice looking trophies and trips to Skywalker Ranch. So
nice.
I'm happy.
All right. So the films that you did that won prizes, mm-hmm. are what?
Well, the first year they did the contest, we did one called Darth Vader Psychic Hotline, which didn't win, but, you know, we tried. But the thing,
I've seen all these, yes. by the way, so I'm chuckling out of recognition, mm-hmm. because you've been very good about making sure that they're available on YouTube and on your Z-Team Productions website.
But with Darth Vader Psychic Hotline, it was one of those cases where we made it trying to win the contest. You know, we didn't make it for the fun of it.
Okay.
And I think that's the difference is, you know, we were trying so hard to win that, you know, the fact that, I mean, we had fun, but we didn't have as much fun as we should have. And I think that shows.
Okay.
The next one that we did was called The Jedi Hunter. I had not planned on doing another fan film. After we did Vader Psychic Hotline, I was like, that's it. And then my friend Denny came up with the idea for this and we're like, oh, yes. And we started writing it in the restaurant where this happened. And the tables around us were laughing.
Yeah.
You know, the jokes we were throwing around. So we're like, we're onto something. And we made it just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
You know, even if there wasn't a contest, we were still going to make it because we wanted to see this.
All right. So the Jedi Hunter, you take someone from the Star Wars universe and you cross him with Steve Irwin, who was still alive at the time. So
it was Boba Fett as the Crocodile Hunter.
So it wasn't in bad taste.
Oh, well, Steve Irwin's still alive back then.
So Boba Fett then is doing what?
He's out there hunting Jedi because that's sort of what he did in the Star Wars universe.
I love it. Fantastic.
And after that, we were like, that's it. We're done. We're not going to do another one because we didn't have any great ideas and we weren't going to do one just for the sake of doing one. We had to have a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 years later, we had a great idea.
And this is probably the one that I'm thinking of, I hope, is my favorite so far.
Sith Apprentice?
Yes.
Yes. Sith Apprentice is the Emperor as Donald Trump looking for his next apprentice, and he's choosing between Darth Vader, Darth Maul, Jar Jar Binks, and Count Dooku.
and it was a really
fast production. We had the idea like literally on New Year's Day, and the deadline for the contest was March 1st. So you know, we made this, and we cranked out this 12-minute parody with massive effect sequences and, you know, 6 weeks.
Now, we should point out that at this point, we're not talking about stop motion with toys any
longer. No, no, no.
You're talking about you and your pals are in Star Wars costumes, in makeup.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it looks like a movie as opposed to...
It is a movie.
Well, you know what I mean. But as opposed to, you know, a guy who's just goofing around playing with toys like on that Robot Chicken show.
Right. Yeah. Well, Crazy Water was just us goofing around with toys. But when we did Darth Vader Psychic Hotline, we got in touch with a guy, a customer in Atlanta named Bob Bean, who's got an incredible Darth Vader suit. And he had so much fun doing that one that he was like, you know, whenever you guys want to do something else, call me. I'll be there.
Oh, yeah. So the guy who owns the suit is, and that's kind of how you get in the movie, right? If you own the suit, you mm-hmm. get in the
exactly.
movie.
Exactly. He had the suit and he was able to come up here to Knoxville to do it. And when we got the idea for Jedi Hunter, we called Bob and say, Bob, do you know anybody with a Boba Fett costume? He's like, yes, I do.
Well, because they're all affiliated with probably Dragon Con and other...
Well, the 501st and various other...
All right, now I know what the 501st is, but you'll have to explain.
The 501st is an international fan group. It was created by Alvin Johnson, which is basically... it's called Vader's Fist. It's the... basically, all the stormtroopers you see all around the world, like the Rose Parade or various other, you know, charity events and stuff like that, that's usually guys that are in the 501st. It's a international group of Star Wars costumers, but it's primarily Imperial stuff. If you're looking at people in other outfits, that's the Rebel Legion or various other groups.
Okay, so these are, when you see at these conventions, you see they make it on the news every once in a while, and like you mentioned, they've been in parades. Mm-hmm. When you see a large group of people all dressed identically in stormtrooper outfits from Star Wars marching down the street in unison,
That's the 501st.
Okay.
But, and, you know, and it's not all just stormtroopers. I mean, you know, they mm-hmm. do other costumes in the Imperial group also.
So when they've got this costume that they've put all this time and money into it, what's involved in creating an authentic-looking costume if you were to take it, well, obviously to a fan film, but also to a fan convention? I mean, I look at some of these costumes and I think, how do they do that?
Well, you know, a lot of people, you know, I don't know specifically because I've never done one myself. I do know at one point Bob said that he put about $7,000 into his Darth Vader costume.
Wow.
But you know, it's not made out of plastic. You know, it's cast fiberglass and, you know, things like that. And, you know,
yeah.
You know, and quilted leather. I mean, you know, there's a, you know, it's not your off-the-shelf Ruby's costume. I mean,
right.
He's trying to make his as perfectly accurate to the original as he can.
Where do you get the diagrams or the patterns or the information, or you just have to freeze frame the DVD, or what do you do?
That or sometimes people, there have been people in the past who've gotten pulls off of original pieces, you know, or people have sculpted one and then cast a mold and then let other people take from that.
Oh, okay.
But the big thing nowadays is there are several pieces from the original trilogy that have gotten into private hands, and people have pulled molds off of those. And
okay, that's what you mean by pulled. Okay.
And then shared those amongst other people who will make, you know, recast. And
so when you say that several pieces of memorabilia from mm-hmm. the original Star Wars movies are sold at auction, and we read about those every once in a while in the news.
Helmet, or armor pieces, you know, various mm-hmm. pieces and parts.
Wow. You'd think Lucas could make a lot of money just selling those, you know?
Well,
selling casts and recasts.
Well, but they do license some of this stuff. I mean, you know, there's places like Master Replicas used to do it, and then there's EFX Collectibles. There are people that make licensed helmets and stuff like that mm-hmm. that are cast from the originals. But
yeah. Now, I'm still amazed that we're talking about all this happening here in East Tennessee, you mm-hmm. being the sort of the eye of this fan film storm that's happening, as you've done Crazy Watto mm-hmm. and you've done the Jedi Hunter, and then, of course, now the Sith Apprentice. So there's three films that you've made right here in East Tennessee that received not just national attention, but local attention. Filmmaker John Hudgens, who's now mm-hmm. created a documentary about that world. But it's not just your films that are in this documentary. Let's talk more about Backyard Blockbusters and what's in that movie.
Well, obviously, like I said, you know, I've done my own fan films, and we were inspired by other fan films that came before us, things like Troops or George Lucas and Love. But, you know, people have been making fan films pretty much as long as people have had cameras.
When you say George Lucas and Love, is it like a spoof of Shakespeare and Love?
Exactly.
Okay.
It was made by a guy named Joe Nussbaum. It was another one of the early, you know, it wasn't made for the internet, but it got out early on the internet. It was like his demo reel. He made it to get attention in Hollywood, and it did get attention.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, it became so popular that when it was finally released on VHS, it actually outsold Star Wars Episode I. No, you know, not in total, but for like a week or two on Amazon, it was actually outselling Episode I.
But Episode I is bad.
It has its moments.
When? The end?
Well, you know, the pod race.
That, oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
I mean, I'll admit it's got problems, but it's got moments, too.
All right. So now you have already having had the experience as a documentarian, having made mm-hmm. the movie about the horror film hosts.
Right.
Now you're going to embark on this movie about other filmmakers making the science fiction fan films. So tell me who else is in this, your movie.
Well, we actually started shooting this while I was shooting American Scary. I was out in L.A. because several other fan filmmakers that I've gotten to know, like Trey Stokes, who did the Pink Five films, he was helping us out on American Scary because there were sometimes I couldn't go out to California for some of the shoots, and so Trey would shoot those for me. You know, I'd go out there, you know, and leave him the camera and the lights, and then I had to come back home, and then he ended up using our camera and lights on one of his films, too. But we'd help each other out. When we did Sith Apprentice, Trey shot some stuff with the Yoda puppet that they had for Sith Apprentice. I've done visual effects for the Pink Five films. But, you know, while we were just sitting around one night, we sort of got the idea, you know, this is kind of cool. Somebody ought to document this. So I just started shooting a couple of interviews with Trey and Chris Hanlon and a few other people while I was still shooting American Scary, just, you know, with the idea that maybe someday somebody will do something with this. I wasn't sure if it was going to be me or not.
Well, let me take a second here to play part of the movie trailer for Backyard Blockbusters, which I'm just taking directly off of your website, Backyard Blockbusters.
Actually, this first audio clip that's going to come up is actually a line from Pink 5.
Okay, and Pink 5, tell me what that is.
Pink 5 is Stacy. She's a Valley girl in the cockpit of an X-Wing fighter.
Okay. All right, so like team leader in Star Wars, they all had like color and number.
Right.
So it was like, who are the real ones?
Well, Luke was Red 5, and then, you know, Gold Leader, Blue Leader, and then there's Stacy, who is Pink 5.
All right. This is from Backyard Blockbusters. You can find it online at backyardblockbusters.net.
You know, this is so cool. I mean, they almost never let me fly, but, like, today, they said that everybody gets to.
I think fan films can be sort of defined as coming from people that want to play in a universe that they love, but they're made not for distribution in theaters, but for other fans. The problem is with the internet, you expand that viewership tremendously.
Well, you have a built-in audience with a fan film that you wouldn't have with an original work.
Troops was probably the first viral video, because, I mean, the concept didn't even exist at the point that you could download an entire movie off the internet. And once people got a taste of that, they're like, you know, I wonder what else I could find on the internet.
Okie doke, shut the camera off.
People are waiting 10, 20 hours to download this thing. And so it just begs the question from the news media, what's worth waiting for 10 or 20 hours to download?
Our episodes are downloaded by upwards of 30 million people. Star Trek Enterprise was being viewed by 3 million people. And Paramount knows that.
Well, I had J.J. Abrams tell me that we showed them the way. We proved that other people could step into the shoes of these iconic characters, because until we did it, it was taboo.
Painters learned how to paint by imitating the great masters, and you learn how to make movies by imitating George Lucas or Spielberg or whoever it is.
We were just some kids on the Gulf Coast that wanted to remake a Raiders movie, and we were just doing it for ourselves. We weren't really concerned about copyright. We weren't aware of copyright. We certainly weren't planning to make any money from it.
The studios have a right to protect their own copyright, but I don't think they should try to crimp the style of amateur filmmakers who are doing it just for fun.
Early on, I was hearing from a lot of studio executives, like, well, we're shutting these guys down. It's like, really? There's some really good stuff out there. You might want to take a look at this.
Lucasfilm and folks like that who find ways to embrace the fan films get the better press. Because, of course, you went, oh, your Warner's shut down that guy's Superman film, you know, and it was really good, and that's terrible. And whereas Lucas, you know, gives you prizes.
What is the meaning of this?
We've opted to not only let people play, but to encourage people to play.
What's going to happen from a copyright perspective when you can't tell the difference between what's made at home and what's made by a studio?
I want the studios to be worried that new original films are going to come out and make their franchise stuff look boring.
Batman Dead End. Look at that quote in Wizard magazine. It's the hottest movie of the summer, but you can't see it in any theater.
You made me, Daddy.
It is an art form where you are going into a project fully knowing that everything that you put into that project will probably never see a return. And this is all driven by money, and fan filmmakers don't see any of that. But they still do it, and they love doing it. And that's dedication to an art form that I have to salute.
It's tales of Hollywood dreams on household budgets, where fans, copyright, and fair use collide. It's stories of fan films and fan filmmakers in Backyard Blockbusters.
And I guess that really, that trailer for Backyard Blockbusters at backyardblockbusters.net does answer a lot of the questions that you have when you think about the money angle. People who do it purely for the love and not for the money.
Exactly. People like Sandy Collera, who did Batman Dead End, you know, he spent about $30,000 making that. Of course, he shot it on film, not on video. But
that's one of the ones that early on in our talk about your upcoming movie, you said make sure you go and watch Batman Dead End. And
right.
I went straight home and watched it.
Yeah, because Batman Dead End is one of those special cases where it actually scared the parent company so much that they went back to Comic-Con the next year and told them, you will never play fan films at this convention again. Because Batman Dead End showed them up. It, you know, people like Alex Ross and Kevin Smith are saying this was the best film depiction of Batman they had ever seen.
Now, where in the timeline of the Batman movies, commercial movies,
this is
movies,
before Batman Begins.
All right, so before Christian Bale, this is like after the George Clooney
After the George Clooney stuff, where, you know, that was the last time we'd seen Batman, and it was horrid.
Yeah.
And then Batman Did End came out, and it was like, you know, and it's basically a guy in a gray flannel suit, you know, kicking butt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it scared Warner Brothers really bad. And then a couple of years later, you know, they go back to the basics and come out with Batman Begins. Now,
right.
Nobody says that they rip Batman Dead On off, but it, as one of the guys in the film says, it basically showed them that they needed to up their game.
Yeah, the Batman Dead End movie characters reminded more of the Batman animated characters in terms of their look.
Right, and there was a lot of influence there in them. Matter of fact, there's one shot in particular, we can't describe it over the radio perfectly, but it's one of those shots where when you see it in the film, everybody who's a Batman fan goes, ooh.
Yeah, it uses the shadows and the cape and all of these things that we're talking about in order to portray, and that's part of the mystery of Batman, is he instills fear by his shape and his design, and that's all in the in the story of it. So that's captured in this fan film, which stuff that you normally only saw in the animated version, because they could draw it better than they could shoot it on film. Until and
all the other Batman films, you know, had never really been done by a fan of Batman. I mean, Sandy Culler was a huge fan, and he had never seen, other than the animated series, he had never seen a live action version of Batman that was treated properly. I mean, you know, Tim Burton came close, but you know, but Tim Burton's films were more about the villains than they were about Batman.
And so was the old Adam West series, was more about the villains, because they hired superstars to play villains, and Adam West and Burt Ward, who were nobodies, to play the heroes.
But, you know, there's all kinds of crazy stories. I mean, people do it insane. But the biggest thing about fan films is most of the time people are not doing it for the money. They're doing it just because they love the characters. There's a guy named Dan Poole up in Baltimore, made his own Spider-Man movie back in 1991, trying to get a job on, at the time, what would have been Jim Cameron's version of Spider-Man. You know, it's never got made, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's out there running around Baltimore, literally swinging four stories up between buildings in a Spider-Man costume, because that's the only way you could do it back
right.
then.
As a fan film, I guess nowadays with fan film, you actually do have CG, computer graphic animation and things
Not
like that.
Not in 1991, you didn't.
But today you do. I mean, you're able to put Darth Vader in the Tennessee Theater and make it look realistic.
Yeah. With fan films, I think it's usually more content than, you know, I mean, you know, as long as something is funny or entertaining, people will forgive, you know, shoddy production values. Because most of the times with fan films, you're not going to have a huge budget. You know, it's basically just some guys in their backyard trying to make something for themselves.
Well, content is king, and it's funny that you should say that, because even the great animated filmmakers, when you look at Disney and Pixar, when they're talking about all that, they talk about it doesn't have to look like a real depiction of a human being. People accept a cartoon character version of a person because it's the story is what they focus on more so than the look of the character. And that's what you're saying too applies to fan films.
Oh yeah.
All right. John Hudgens is our guest. We're talking about his new movie, Backyard Blockbusters, the website backyardblockbusters.net. So the Dragon Con screening went well. You were the kickoff, the lead off for that.
Yeah, lead film in the festival. We were screening out of competition because they sort of slotted us in at the last minute.
Okay.
I wasn't sure I was going to have it ready in time for Dragon Con.
But you are ready for the Secret City Film Festival competition. What's involved in that?
Well, basically, I had to get the film to them a couple of weeks ago, just so they could, you know, one of the cool things, and this is not just for me, this is for everybody, Keith McDaniel, the guy that runs Secret City Film Festival, has set up a thing with Regal Cinemas where they're converting all the films in the festival to the digital cinema format so that they'll all be screened digitally.
How do you submit them then? What format do you turn?
I give it to them on a hard drive, uncompressed video. You know, it was like a 200 gigabyte file, but.
Oh, wow. So he makes it so that it can play, because obviously Regal Cinemas now only has digital projectors. They don't have film projectors anymore, so you have to find a format that'll play in the building or it's not going to be seen.
Right, and you know, this is converting into their standard in-house DCP format, but they're doing that for all the films in the festival, not just the features, the shorts, I mean everything.
Because there's even little seven-minute pieces that are going to be shown.
Right.
Oh, I'm in one of them, by the way.
Oh.
I forgot to tell you.
I didn't know that.
I forgot to tell you that I got a message from a filmmaker saying, hey, We're making a movie about spies, kind of like, you know, CIA, FBI type of thing. We need somebody to come in and yell at somebody.
Oh, is this one of the seven-day shootout things?
Seven-day shootout. They had to make a movie in 7 days, and they asked me if I would come in. And literally, I spent 1 hour there yelling at a guy, and then, then I went home.
Yeah, I wasn't able to participate in the seven-day shootout because a lot of that took place while I was in Atlanta for DragonCon. So
yeah, exactly. That's when I did it. It was over Labor Day weekend. All right, well, good luck at the Secret City Film Festival. I hope you take home a nice prize for that.
And like to.
Also with the future distribution of Backyard Blockbusters and whatever the next thing on the horizon is for John Hudgens.
Well, hopefully more movies.
Absolutely. Great. Well, good luck. BackyardBlockbusters.net is the website. John Hudgens is our guest. We appreciate you being here. Good luck
at
the Secret City Film Festival. This is the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.